My name is Christy Fagan. I'm a runner. A runner is like, why we call a runner as the free blood. And that was the word that was used to me for years. I mean, I was always free blood. I mean, there was nowhere that I can, no matter what they done to me, couldn't hold me.
A report from the Commission on Child Abuse has strongly criticised the Department of Education, which it said generally dismissed or ignored complaints of child sexual abuse in residential institutions.
When you go into them places, and you know, you look around you, the first you look for is I'm getting away here, I'm running.
The Ryan report was published on May 20th, 2009.
They used to bait me, that's why my legs are so bad. They used to bait my ankles with holies.
It contained thousands of stories of physical and sexual abuse in industrial schools. Where I'm from, where Jemmy Gunnery is from, we had heard these stories before.
The report says sexual abuse was a chronic problem at Fairy House Industrial School. Sexual abuse was systemic. When it was uncovered, it was not seen as a crime, but as a moral lapse and weakness.
So he smacked my ankles with holies, and my legs would swell up, and I'd wear the boots that would be probably four or five times so big on me, right? And they'd be tied, and I wouldn't get stockings. I mean, you used to wear the, I always had boots with no stockings, because I was known as a runner.
This story is about the Ferry House Industrial School.
And every time you got back on your feet, you come around, right? It depends on which one of them animals that was looking after you on the day, right? And you get a kick, or you get a bang. And that's the reason why it was to stop you from running, to stop it, that you couldn't move.
Christy Fagan, like Michael O'Brien, was there.
I went to the Laffey Commission and you had seven barristers there questioning me and telling them I was telling lies when I told them that I got raped of a Saturday, got a merciful beating after it, and then he came along the following morning and put Holy Communion in my mouth. They brought a man over from Rome, 90 odd years of age, to tell me I was telling lies, that I wasn't beaten for an hour, non-stop, by two of them! Non-stop, from head to toe, without a shred of cloth on my body. My God, Minister. That woman will tell you how many times I jump out of the bed at night with the sweat pumping out of me because I see these fellas at the end of the bed with their fingers doing that to me and pulling me into the room to rape me, to bugger me, and beat the shite out of me.
The word runner is not in the Ryan report. It was the name given by Christian Brothers to children who escaped.
Free blood to me now is that you've never stopped me, right? No matter what chance I got. I mean, no matter how much they bet you. I mean, you've seen an opening, you're your blood, you're free.
This is the story of the runners and a man, Jemmy Gunnery.
But as Jimmy always said, you're a free man. You're a free boy, he said. Never stop running, no matter where you're at. Make your way. I never stopped trying to escape. And it ends up there. I mean, as I said, you could break it, bang, smash your legs, or damage your legs, not a whole lot. But once you got out off them grounds there, and you're going to go into them fields there, I mean, the way you were going, right? Your legs didn't bother you. You carry yourself, I mean. You put it in your mind, I mean, I'm going home, I'm free. And they caught me in a good mood. I don't even know what I'm doing.
Christy Fagan is returning for the first time in 40 years to Ferry House Industrial School in Clonmel.
You said you still have a hold of you, no matter how long there is. But, this is a big day today.
Christy's brother, Terry, is with him. You'll hear more from Terry later.
And I said, you're right, I don't know what's taught this 40 years, but it's like yesterday. It's like, and there's a blocker there now, and you just can't get rid of it. And hopefully this will put an end to it today. So all the memories, all the badness, all the evil, the baitings and things, you know what I mean? It's pure evil, and that's been in there, and I've never lost it.
As the train makes its way, green fields flash by the window. The very fields that when Christy was a child, he ran through, trying to find his way home.
I was small. I was very small. I was probably 9, 10. I'm not too sure of my age or what I was down there. Never stopped. I escaped at night. I escaped during the night. I escaped when you're in mass. I escaped when you were swimming. I escaped when you were walking. I mean, no matter what opened the night, I was gone.
He nearly reached Dublin once. He was arrested on the outskirts, 171 kilometres away from Ferry House.
So I got out one of the times, and I got there. I was one of the times I was lying on the embankment, waiting until it got dark. I went out across, up, looking across to the hills there. When you got out, you'd head for the, keep off the main roads, and head down, I showed you the hills there, up that way you go, and you'd stay low in the daytime and moving the nighttime. And don't ask me how I got to where I got to Dublin, but I got near enough to it. And as I used to sleep, you know, lie down in the daytime and walk in the nighttime. Wherever you had the scallions, I looked on scallions and there were solid antlers. Antlers that was in the ground I lived on. And that's what kept me going, made my way home. You weren't lonely because you were free. Because you were your own man, your own kid. I mean, you'd know to tell you what to do. And no one to be watching over you all the time, I hate you. And I didn't feel frightened or anything. Because how could you feel frightened after what you went through down there? I mean, once you get away from me, you get away from me. I mean, you weren't looking back. But I mean, I know I was walking for a long time. And I got caught by a couple of the farmers. And that time, I think the story was then, I didn't know, I only heard it afterwards, that the farmers used to get £5 and whatever, they got £5 in money, but they got a hold of bringing you back. I mean, so you know, like when you were out, it was like all the bounty hunters looking for you. Including the people in the farms not looking for you, not all right. So, I mean, they're brushing brush, but they like, pass on the word, that we'll see the same, there's one loose, you know what I mean? And the only thing was, when you got caught, you knew you were going in, you were getting the bait, you know what I mean? I escaped and I had brothers chasing me, and I ran them into the ground. And because I ran them into the ground, I paid for them when I got brought back.
Forty years on, we arrive in Clonmel.
Have your attention, please. Shortly now arriving in Clonmel. Clonmel, next stop.
Here's the big moment now.
This story, though, the story of Jemmy Gunnery begins with a promise in a flat in the corporation buildings. It's 1968. It's night time. A woman, a widow, has lost her 12-year-old son. Jemmy Gunnery shakes the woman's hand. Jemmy Gunnery makes a promise.
I watched him going out through the front gate of Corporation Buildings with my sister-in-law, and I remember him looking back at me. He just looked back at me, and, you know, I like it was a goodbye look. You know, I just looked at him and I said, Jesus, I just, you know, I remember coming back into the room and I sat there. I just hung around the house that day and waited to see what would happen.
A distinctive smell came from the Mitchell Rosary Bead factory. A smell that arose when the horns and hoofs of cows were melted. A process necessary to create the holy beads.
And I remember it seemed like he was gone forever. And next of all, the door opened and in came my sister-in-law.
Christy and the other children of his age would play on a patch of waste ground beside Mitchell's factory.
And I could see the tears in her eyes. My mother just looked at her. And my mother let out a merciful scream. She said, no, no, no.
It was somehow inevitable that Christy would one day gravitate to the strange-smelling building and climb its walls.
My sister-in-law didn't have to say anything. My mother read her face. And then she said, he's gone. They sentenced him to 7 years.
In 1968, in Roman Catholic Ireland, Christy Fagan was charged with breaking and entering into a rosary bead factory.
7 years for stealing beads. I remember pulling out her hair, like, you know, and kind of shaking her head, you know, and when the sister-in-law was standing there in the doorway. And with that scream brought neighbours running. The women were standing beside her and they were trying to calm her down and the whole lot. And in came Jemmy. Jemmy was a kind of a smallish, stocky man, well-built, strong. Like, he walks in and I can recall him walking straight towards her and he put his arm around her. You know, he was my father's friend. They walked the docks together.
Like Christy Fagan, like so many, Jemmy Gunnery, as a young child, was sent to an industrial school.
He knew what was going on in those schools, and he knew he wasn't going to let my brother go through that.
Jemmy Gunnery never said why he did what he did. He never talked about it.
His crime was, from what I know, it was stealing bread out of a bread van. That was his crime. You know, and 4 years for stealing bread. He would have went into the industrial schools in the 1930s, right? And they were a bleak period. They'd go into those schools in the 30s. See, in those days, people didn't know what was going on. But Jemmy Gunnery did. He knew what was going on because he was a man that suffered. Now, I didn't know that till years after.
My father never talked about it. He never told me once that he'd been in trouble. We never thought he'd done time, nothing. It was somebody else that told me. His family told me. His mother actually told me one time about it, but he wouldn't talk about it. He never talked about it at all. He never told him. I remember I asked him once about the scar on his face, and he told me that a prison word, and I hit him across the face with a bunch of kids.
There was some reason that he didn't say. Obviously, he had a reason why he didn't want to talk about it. It was actually the granny that told us about it. Like, my father's mother told us about it. He just said he was wild. And that he had been sent away when he was young. But don't know why he never said anything about it, but he was always determined to help other young kids that was in trouble for some reason. So obviously he had his own reasons for doing it. Maybe it's because of what he went through. I really think that was much similar to what went on in our town. Like, just reading between the lines, it must have been for him to help children that was in trouble. He had to be through something himself, something that he never spoke about. Other than that, I don't think he would have bothered helping anybody, so there must have been something there that he was willing to help anybody that was in trouble.
Jemmy Gunnery was released from the industrial school. As the sun set in that day, Jemmy was on a boat.
His mother met him at the station and told him he'd be better off out of the country because obviously all the kids were getting sent away for little or nothing, no matter what they done. They missed school, they were sent away. So she gave him the money to go away. And off when he went to be down to B&I himself, went to Liverpool.
16 years of age. Dublin, his family, the industrial skills slowly becoming a dot on the horizon. Jemmy Gunnery sailed to Liverpool.
He was by himself. There was no one there to see him go. And he swore he wouldn't come back. There was no one there to wave him off. All he knew, he was going to another country. He didn't know where he was going, nowhere to go. And when he got there, he was sleeping in the streets for weeks. And that was actually how he met my mother. My mother worked in a cafe and he used to go in and she used to give him his breakfast for nothing.
No one knows why, but Jemmy decides to go home. Jemmy Gunnery sailed into the Dublin Docklands with his young family.
There was one spade, actually, I think, weighed 2 stone. They used to call it number 7. Then there was my dad used to say the smallest spade, that was a squarehead. And that's the one that you used when you were nearly finishing, because you're on the floor of the boat. But then they used to start off with the number 7. And, I mean, it's number 7 long weight, I think it was 1 or 2 stone, at least 2 stone in weight. And he had to lift that, and that carried at least 4 or 5 stone of coal on top of it. So every time he put it in, he was getting up 5 or 6 stone at least. And he was doing about 8 and 12 hours a day. He had big arms, big, huge arms. Big arms he had.
He was actually that strong. He was buried under tons of coal one time, wasn't he?
He was.
The thing collapsed on him.
The tub of coal fell on top of him once. But he had very, can you imagine, very strong arms.
Yeah.
Very, very strong. He could bend 6-inch nails and over his hands. No problem to him. And that was the truth. No problem to him.
Remember when we were small, he used to pick us up with his teeth.
Yeah.
I can't believe this. Jeez. I don't. Teddy. Huh?
40 years on, little remains of the Ferry House industrial school.
Where's the main building? The yard and all that.
This is it. It's changed.
Like,
it's absolutely all changed.
Jeez, I wouldn't know this place. I wouldn't know it at all. Where's the big, the old building that was there? I mean, where the dormitories was, the workshops was and all the whole lot.
The dormitory building is now gone.
How many was in that dormitory?
Can you imagine? It's about 20 or more, I'm not too sure. But there could have been a lot more, I mean.
Mm. Which way was the beds?
The beds were all lined. No, beyond one another, I mean. Yeah. And yeah, you had two or three rows. Two
come into in the night time to check.
They come in a minute and he'd pretend to put his hand in, you know, to see the, pretend to let them see was your bed wet and all that.
Yeah.
No such thing. No such thing at all.
What would you be doing?
Touching you and doing things, I mean. But if you lay there and didn't do anything, you were in big trouble, I mean. He was a wolf. That's what he called him. That's the name he put on me. Called him as your kid. He was the wolf, the grey wolf.
He was a brother, was he?
Christian brother, yeah.
Rasminian brother.
Whatever you call it, I don't know what the difference between them. All the bleeding same to me, you know what I mean?
The only building still standing is the gable end of the old church.
This was the church where you were in.
This is the church there where I was, boy. Yeah. And you said that was supposed to be a safe haven for you. That was like a torture chamber.
Church was?
Yeah, oh yeah. When you got into the church, there was no going. They disturbed them, must have. I mean, you were in there. And they said that they're there.
That's where the abuse took place.
They're in the church as well, yeah. And people would say, no, that it happened in the church. Mm. And it happened in the confession boxes.
How
are you feeling? Yeah. You okay? Just the fact that the water up there,
That's the walk. Up that way where we came in that time.
Yeah, I know that, yeah.
That was
yeah.
the bridge. That's where the car was parked up here.
That's the bridge there.
That's the bridge there. We went across, I think, that bridge. Mm.
And We actually hid out here.
You hid out here?
Along the things there, yeah. We actually spent a day there, one of these places. Let them think that I was gone completely.
Yeah.
Actually lay in the thing there for a whole day. And they thought I was escaping, but they thought I was gone off. I lay for the whole day and then moved off in the night time.
From here?
I lay in the riverbank there, I lay there. And the place crawled.
What?
Fucking rats and everything. And I remember lying there. We done that a couple of times. That's the way I used to. How would you get out? I went across the bridge river. I went to the river. I'd actually lie in there in the daytime. When we get out in the day, there's no chance of getting out in the day. I'd lie in there and wait till it got dark. Then moved off. I went the wrong ways a few times, don't I?
Can you just describe for me again where we are in relation to the...
We're on the riverbank up there, beside the school. There's a side entrance walking down onto the bank here. And what I used to do with you was we could get up, you come over the wall, the thing there, right? You get into the riverbank here, you're lying here, until it got dark. So the brothers would think you were actually gone ahead. And then you moved up in the night. Then you moved up when it got dark. Then, and you made your way. I mean, but most times you try and crawl along, get along as far as way to the school as you could. I mean, then come out of the bushes. Then, so what you actually did was you made your way through the bushes, right on the bank here, to get out to a safe spot upon where you could come out then, and then make your way then.
You must be ripped to pieces, right?
Everything was scraped to bits, I mean. Mm. But as I said, you'd have done anything to get it down, to get away from them. You'd have done anything to get away from them, I mean.
You've got to love you.
And, but there was they'd always trying to bait out your way, where you stayed, where'd you go that day, you know what I mean? So if you did do it again, they'd know where to look for you, you know what I mean? You know what route you're going to take and all the whole lot, right?
You didn't tell him.
But I'd never told him about the bank. That was something I kept down. And I'd never told him which way. I'd lie there. And I mean, if you got a chance early morning, you'd lie there from early morning to the last thing, till you got to get back. And then make your way through the thing then to get out.
Hmm.
But then people have no idea what went on down here. So the abuse down here was constant down here, and the hidings and the baitings were constant. This place now, I mean, as I said to you, I look at a couple of the films about the concentration camps. I never even compared it to here, but when you think about it, there was a guard standing over there and you were left alone. But down here you were never left alone. You never had peace down here. From the time you came in to the time you left, there was always something happening. You might get a day or two that you go, boy, you'd be okay. But then be another day then. That's them taking their breaks and whatever, you know what I mean? So that's that, you know what I mean? I said, carry on, you've no idea of the torture. You know, and just looking at the hills there, the mountains there, right? That's where we used to head for as well. We used to make it up. And head for the high ground. That's where you stay for a couple of days. Before you come back down there and move off then. Them hills were always in my dreams.
Back to the story of the runners. So where are we? Here's a little refresher. It's the north side. It's 1968. Jemmy Gunnery, a docker, promises a widow that he will free her son from an industrial school.
These things take time, Jemmy would say. He needed to get a van first.
He turned up in the house and he said to me, Mother, he said, listen, I might have been down in Clonmel. I had to look at the school. We can get him out of there, right? So my mother was all excited and he said, come down. And he said to me, Terry, I'm going to need your help. I said, no problem. I said, I'll do anything. I said, there's no problem on that. So we left Corporation Buildings around about 7 o'clock that morning. I made our way down to Tipperary, to Clonmel. And I remember we drove along the road, and the school was, where we came in from, the school was on the left-hand side. And I got out of the car and I walked towards, this man came out of the school. And I walked over and I said, where's all the boys? Oh, he said, no, he said, they're in the far field. He said, the sports day next week. He said, and they're training over there in the fields. So I said, thank you. And I walked back over to the car. And I said to Jemmy and my mother and that, saying, I said, Jemmy, we'll never get him. He's in the far field. I said, we try and snatch him out there now. I said, so we'll never make it. He said, no. He said, leave her. He said, next Sunday here is. So the following Sunday, Jemmy was there waiting. 7 o'clock again, into the car and went down. And we kind of got out of the car and went in around into the industrial school. And I never forget it because it was crowded, the industrial school was, right? And I stood in amongst the crowd. And so anyway, I was watching, and next of all, I spotted Christy, God love him, his little bony legs, and he was running.
But I mean, being there, and it's like being in a concentration camp. I mean, and that's basically what it was like. To me, it was like a concentration camp, and it's pretty hard for people to understand it. If you come from the heart of the city, right, and you're put down there, and I mean, no matter what corner you're turning, there's somebody that's slapping you or hitting you. And you'd know to turn to. And that's it. When I was running on the track and I see my mother and your brother and Jimmy Gunnery there, Jesus, I mean, up to this present day, I've never had a feeling like it since. Because it's people can win the lotto and they're over the moon, but that was my lotto when I seen them down there, getting me out, taking me out of there. And I was running around the field and I just run down the race and I copped my mother, your brother Terry and Jimmy standing there. And they told me to keep running. So they said, Terry said to me, says he, yeah.
I said, Christy, when you go around by the school, go through the gap in the hedge over there, which was nearly onto the main road. I said, Jemmy said, the car be waiting on you. You know, and Christy looked and he seen Jemmy in the hole. His face just lit up. It was like he knew this is it. Well, he took off like an Olympic runner. And I moved, as I said, towards the gate to cover in case the brothers came after him to take, because I was willing, if need be, if they had a came to try and stop him, I was willing to fight them. And because I had something in my jacket, which I would have used if it had been necessary to use it, because Jemmy had said to me, bring something with you in case anything goes wrong. He said, the Christian brothers are very handy with the hurley sticks. He said, they'll smash our face in quick as anything. So I carried something there with me. And thank God it didn't have to arise, because I would have used it.
What did you carry?
I carried a hammer and I had a Northern bar in my jacket. I'm just stuck down the waistband. And I would have used those to protect my brother. And I wouldn't have thought twice about it. You know? And I actually, Jemmy knew that should anything go wrong, I was going to be left behind. I didn't mind. I didn't mind one bit. And anyway, I moved towards the gate. And then I watched Christy coming around from the school entrance. And up, there was a little kind of a little hill type of thing which led into a kind of a ravine. There was a little ravine, as far as I can recall, at the side of the road. So we got Christy into the car. I ran around and got him up, pulled him in, got him into the car, got him down into the back seat of the car, down, pushed down. My mother, I can't describe it. She was hugging him and holding him, kissing him and the whole lot. And we sped off.
There was hugs and kisses with my mother and all. She was the Lord. And Jemmy, I mean, he'd always call me. He didn't name me. Call me the wild boy, he used to call me, you know what I mean? But he said, Sissy, now you're out. He said, you're not going back this time. He said, there's no one taking you back. So he turned around and says, Sissy, they're not taking you back anymore. He said, yeah, been through enough. When I got into the car then, and I was lying on the floor of the car, and I was actually busting to go to the toilet. And Jemmy said, you can't get out of the car, he said, because we have to keep going. Jemmy said, he was a great man. So he said, Sissy, what to do? See, here, there's a lemonade bottle, go to the toilet and that. So right now I went to the toilet. But the problem was, I went to the toilet too much. I actually filled the bottle up. I was actually getting poured at the window while we were travelling.
We headed up to the Rock of Cashel, right, until instead we got dark. because Jimmy knew, he said, look, if we head off now, they'll be checking Dublin registration cards when he's missed. And he said, we'd never make it through. But we stayed there till it got dark. I'd never seen the Rock of Cashel before. Like, you know what I mean? And all I know, we were up at the Rock of Cashel. Jimmy said, this is the Rock of Cashel, right? Because I'd never seen the country down there before. Like, I hadn't got a clue where it was, even. Like, you know, now I knew it was Clonmel, Tipperary, but I hadn't got a clue about the Rock of Cashel. It never meant anything to me, you know, but we were up there. We stayed a couple of hours. Your mother was, as I said, rubbing Christy's hair, kissing him and the whole lot. Jimmy was laughing and the whole lot, you know. And I remember him saying, he said, I kept me promise, didn't I, Mrs.?
That night, they drove back to Dublin. Terry and Jimmy in the front, Christy and his mother in the back. Late at night, they arrived back in the city.
And I was in my house, and a knock comes to the door, getting out of the industrial school, and he wanted to take him in. Oh my God! I nearly died. I didn't know what was happening anyway. Like, and I was kind of worried, you know. And I was worried about the police coming up to the door, and I didn't know. And then I couldn't put the poor child out and throw the child out into their arms, you know, that way. But when I seen Jimmy coming up, and then what could I do? Just take him in. Like, kind of, what would you do? You just wouldn't throw a child out to the police. Like, so we took him in anyway for 3 days.
The escape was the easy part, the straightforward part. Jimmy knew what was coming. The guards would be searching for the missing boy. There would be raids. The boy would have to be hidden. Jimmy had a plan.
So it was then Jimmy came up with the idea. See, Christy had kind of curly hair. And that's when he came up with the idea. He said, like, to Christy to put the dress on him, you know, to dress him up. He said, Christy, he said, if you want to stay out of these schools, he said, Sissy, and you want to stay ahead of the police, he said, Sissy, you're going to have to wear a dress, you know. So Christy, I think, was so alert, he didn't care. So they got the dress for him and he had him in the dress. And that was Christy went around in the daytime with the dress. You know, in the nighttime he wore his own clothes, of course. But he was hopping in and out and running around the whole lot, you know, and it was great laugh in the family with Christy with his dress, you know.
It was a little flowery dress, little flower thing, isn't it? And he had a little cardigan, a dress and a cardigan. It was a dress and a cardigan and the sandals, the plastic sandals. And I mean, I wore that dress for a long time. I was dressed up in Jimmy's, right? And he says, they're looking for a boy, they're not looking for a girl. And I could actually play on the bankney. And the police were going up, my mother's looking for me. And I'd be playing on the bankney. And that time we'd be playing, skipping or piggy, whatever it was, not out of right. And I'd be playing up and down that bankney, not a bother. And he'd say, don't you dare go down that floor. He said, you're playing on the bank this way, Stein. And I played on the bank. He went to dress me for a long time. But, I mean, you'd have worn that, not to go back down that hell hole, I mean. You wouldn't give a damn what you wore, I mean. Once you wouldn't go back down there, I mean.
Terry has made a small laminated poster. It remembers Jimmy. They look for a tree to attach it to.
No, Jimmy, this is for you. What's that going to go in? That's for you, Jimmy, me pal.
Can you read it out there?
I'll read it.
Can you read it out? Can you read it, please?
This is a photograph of the late Jimmy Gunnery, who helped children escape from the notorious industrial schools. And on this photograph states, it's a quote from Edmund Burke, all that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing, Edmund Burke. And underneath it says, this good man, James Jimmy Gunnery, did something. In the late 1960s, he rescued a young boy from this one-time hellhole of an industrial concentration camp run by the Rosmini brothers. Jimmy, you kept your word.
Now, Chris, I'm going to take a photograph there beside you. For the Gunnery family.
There's always one question that persists. To his family and friends. Was there more? Did Jemmy Gunnery help any other children to escape?
Jesus, if he's alive now, he'd be laughing, wouldn't he, Jemmy?
Yeah.
He'd break his heart laughing just now, he was alive, Lord of Mason. Kept to his word, all right, Teddy.
It is. What he don't forget, how many kids he helped, you know, and what schools he went to, you know, and how many kids that was in the house. I'd say them, all those questions, I reckon, are gone to the grave. The answers to them questions are gone to the grave. I don't honestly think there's anybody alive could answer them questions.
Well, I can recall being in the house of Jemmy, right, and I can recall big time loads of escapees, right, not around one given time, in and out of the house, different things, and you'd know, because you'd see Jemmy's wife there buttering bread, giving them sandwiches and things like that, like, you know. And you knew they were runners, like, you know. And that's what the names the Christian Brothers gave them when they escaped, you called runners.
My name is Mick Forden. I'm from Corporation Place. And I grew up most of the kids that you were asking about. I know Jimmy Gunnery as long as I'm alive, I think. We all knew each other. Like, you could hear, like, I mean, the walls in the Corporation buildings were very thin. If you didn't want to hear the argument that was going upstairs, you could listen to the arguments going on downstairs. I seen him with... I remember, I know of two or three young boys he did help out. But, I mean, I'm not prepared to say their names in case they were agreed, you know, that I'd do that, you know. Jimmy would brief them, you know, and tell them not to let the left hand know what the right hand is doing. A famous saying of his, you know. He'd bring them back to Corporation Street or wherever they came from around the area, Foley Street or Liberty House or Sheriff Street. He knew they'd probably know their fathers mainly. And he had to brief their fathers and mothers to let them know in case they'd be annoyed about it, you know what I mean? Jemmy had a little four Thames van, and he used to go down the country for Sunday morning early. He'd head off early, and he'd get down there, and he'd bring someone back, and he'd head off very early, as I said to you. That's all I know, and I mean, he wouldn't actually tell you. You know what I mean? He wouldn't broadcast or tell anybody what was going on, but you'd know, but it could talk about nothing more, but I didn't, like, it's only that these fellas would be my friends, that I'd be kind of, and I'd live beside him, that I'd know. But I mean, he could have sprung another half dozen kids from around the area, like from outside Corporation Place, you know what I mean? And I'd say he did myself.
I remember then that word was sent in that Jemmy was very sick. So I made my way out to the house. And I'd never forget, he was sitting in an armchair. And he was happy in the hola. I had a cup of tea with him, and we were reminiscing about Corporation buildings in the hola. And I was talking about Christy and the whole lot, and that brought a smile to his face, like, you know. I said, Jemmy, did you ever think of it, you know? And he shook his head. And I said, Jemmy, tell us more. I said, what did you do? And who else did you help? Ah, he said, better off leaving that alone. Forget about that. That's not to be talked about, more or less, he said to me.
No, I never knew anything. Just as I was running around that track, I mean, I can't explain that feeling to you. It's very hard to people understand it. I mean, once I seen Jemmy there, I knew I was going home. And home we went. And I never forget it. Believe me, I still think of it. But I said, if it wasn't for Jemmy, I would have been probably a lot worse than I was than I am today.
But they sent those children into hell. And my brother went through hell. And I only found out not too long ago what he actually suffered. And I have to tell you, there's some anger in me. But like everything else, you know, I recognise there's good Christian brothers out there that do great work in the community. And they lived the spirit of Ignatius Rice. They were good. And I feel very sad for those Christian brothers, the good Christian brothers that did help communities and are still helping communities. I feel sad for them. Jemmy, like Ignatius Rice, who founded the Christian Brothers and helping poor children, Jemmy done the same, but in a different way. He saved them from the evil brothers that were running those schools.
Them hills were always in my dreams. I love them hills. Them ones there, I've never lost my mind. When I'm over the hill, I'm free. That was always my dream. When I see the hill, when I'm over the hill, I'm free. I mean, I've, even sometimes I'm in bed lying down thinking,
I could see them hilts. So I was still not free. Because I see them hills as my freedom. And one day I'll get over them. One day I will get over them. I definitely will. I will make it. Will it be there? I'll definitely get over them.
If you enjoyed this documentary, you might like to listen to our other Documentary on One productions. Visit rte.ie/docon1.